The wind was offshore, a faint backlash of the monsoon, but the sky was low and grey, and the twisting squalls of rain fell from it like pearl dust. Ensign Ferris, Black Joke's most junior officer, was taking his sights off the traverse board as the gunboat closed the land, calling them quietly to the signals yeoman, who swiftly worked out the distance offshore and wrote this down on the navigation slate, so that any moment the captain could glance down at it to confirm his own observations. There was a man in the bows with a lead line chanting the depth as he read it from the markings on the line, then twirling the weight and hurling it out ahead of Black Joke's creeping bows, letting it sink, and then reading the mark again as the ship passed over it. By the deep, six. Clinton Codrington was conning his ship in by the leadsman's chant. By the angles that Ferris was shooting off the land features which they had identified, by the colour shadings of the water, by the break and swirl of the tide on shoal and bank, and by a seaman's instinct. The chart surveyed 30 years previously by Captain Owen, R.N., he trusted not at all. "Bring her round a point," he told the helmsman quietly, and as the ship swung towards the land, they smelt it on the wind. "Slave stink!" exclaimed Denham fiercely, and as he said it, the masthead lookout sang out sharply, "Smoke! Smoke from the right bank of the river! How far upstream?" 2 miles or more, sir." For the first time since sailing from Zanzibar Harbour, Clinton allowed himself to believe that he was in time, that he had reached the Rio Save in time to answer the heart-rending appeal of the woman he loved. "We will clear for action, if you please, Mr. Denham, but don't run out the guns." He kept his voice level and formal, but his lieutenant grinned at him. "A fair cop, by Jove. Congratulations, sir." And the crew laughed and skylarked as they lined up at the arms chest to receive their pistol and cutlasses. As Black Joke breasted the breaking white water of the bar, touched sand bottom for a moment and then broke the grip of it, and surged forward into the dark green and still waters of the estuary, Clinton nodded at Denham. "You may run out the guns now." He had delayed until this moment to avoid altering the ship's trim during the critical passage of the bar. With the carriages rumbling ominously, Black Joke bared her fangs, and under fighting sail, her bronze propeller thrashing exultantly, her crew armed and eager, she went into the labyrinth of the Rio Save like a ferret into the warren. Clinton took her around the first bend, following the deep green sweep of the channel between the paler sandbanks. It was 2 hours past low tide, and the flood was pushing strongly, the leadsman calling good bottom, and Clinton was trying to conceal his impatience and eagerness by the calm, controlled tone in which he called his orders to the helm. "Would you just look at that?" exclaimed Ferris, and pointed over the side. Beside them floated what looked like an ebony log. It was only as they passed, and it bobbed and rolled in their wake, that Clinton realized that it was a human corpse, stomach distended, round and shiny with gas, and limbs twisted like the branches of a tree blasted by lightning. Clinton transferred his attention back to the ship with a small grimace of distaste. "Meet her," he told the helmsman. And then as they tore round the broad curve of water between the mangrove forests and the full stretch of the estuary opened ahead of them, he said, "Midships." His voice was flat, unemotional, neither triumphant nor dejected. Smoke rose from the bank of the river, and through his glass he could see the smouldering remains of a series of long, low buildings. Roofs burned through and collapsed inwards. They seemed to have been deliberately fired. In the smoke, soaring and circling on spread wings, rose a host of birds, buzzards and kites and vultures, and the carrion-eating marabou storks. They seemed to reach up with the smoke to the belly of the lowering monsoon clouds, dimming the light of day with their wings. The oppressive, towering silence was broken only by the faint, high cries of the birds. And the river was empty. Clinton and his officers stared silently at the wide, deserted sweep of the Rio Save, green and smooth from bank to mangrove-clad bank. No one spoke as Black Joke bore on. close in to the ruined and blackened Maracoons. They stared at the piles of corpses, their faces stiff and expressionless, concealing their horror at the foul plague that lurked there in the palm groves, concealing also their disappointment and chagrin at finding the anchorage deserted and Huron gone. "Stop engine," Clinton broke the silence. "Let go port anchor." Denham and Ferris turned to look at their captain, their carefully controlled expressions cracking with disbelieving dread. He was going to send a party ashore. They would come back aboard carrying the plague with them. They would all be doomed. The bow anchor hit the mud of the estuary bottom, and Black Joke turned sharply, the flow of the tide swinging her across the narrow channel in her own length, the anchor holding her head until she was pointed directly back down the river towards the sea. Clinton gave the order. "Slow ahead," and as the ship breasted the tide, "Up anchor," and the steam winch clattered merrily. The officers relaxed visibly, and Denham allowed himself to smile with relief. The captain had used the anchor merely to turn the ship as swiftly as possible, without going through the dangerous business of backing and filling in the narrow channel against the push of the tide. As the anchor came back aboard, with the gluey black mud clinging to its flukes, Clinton gave another series of orders. "Half ahead." That was as fast as he dared push for the open sea. "Secure from action stations." There was no enemy to fight, and as the heavy, long-barreled 32-pounder guns were run in, Black Joke handled more easily. "Mr. Ferris, we will fumigate the ship." The smoke from the pails of burning sulphur would redden all their eyes and for days would taint the food and water. But Clinton's dread of smallpox outweighed such small considerations as comfort. And besides, he smiled wryly to himself, any change to the taste of Black Joke's bullied beef and hard bread could only be an improvement. The smile was fleeting. He was sickened by his brief glimpses of the Barracoons, and his anger was a cold, sharp thing, like the blade of the cutlass on his belt. "Mr. Denham," he said quietly, "please plot a course for Good Hope. We'll come on to it the moment we clear the land." He moved to the rail, half his mind on the job of conning Black Joke out of the stinking green river into the open sea, the other half of his mind running swiftly over the problem of bringing his ship into action against Huron. How long was the start that the tall clipper had over his gunboat? Robin Ballantyne's letter had been dated the 16th of November. Today was the 27th of November. 11 days. That was too much. He could only hope that Robin had been able to delay the sailing, as she had promised. Clinton glanced back over his shoulder at the blue smoke column that blurred the horizon. How long had those fires in the Barracoons been burning? No more than 3 or 4 days, he guessed, with more hope than conviction. Yet even that was still too long a start. He had seen Huron on a wind, and she was swift as a swallow and light as a witch. Even with 800 slaves in her holds and her water casks filled, she would toy with Black Joke in any wind better than a light breeze. His only advantage would be in the offing that Huron must make to get onto the trades and weather the bulge of the continent, while Black Joke could cut across the other arm of the triangle, hugging the land. It was small advantage, a few hundred leagues, and in the end it would all depend on the wind. Clinton found he was pounding his clenched fist on the ship's rail, that he was glaring ahead with such ferocity that the idle hands of the lee rail were watching him curiously. With an effort, he forced his features to relax and linked his hands at the small of his back beneath the tails of his uniform coat. But his eyes still glittered pale sapphire blue and his lips were chalky with stress. It seemed too long for his patience before he could at last bring Black Joke onto her true course and bend to the engine room voice tube. "I want all the speed you can squeeze out of her," he told his engineer. "There is £20,000 of prize money just below the horizon, but it's running like a fox, and I'll need every pound of steam you can give me." He straightened up, and the wind whipped his pale golden hair against his sun-gilded cheeks and forehead. He glanced up at the sky and saw the ponderous roll of the monsoon clouds on the wind. Huron would have it full and boisterous on her port beam. With that howl and rigging, it was probably her best point of sailing. He knew that there was not the remotest chance of finding the clipper on the open sea. There were millions of square miles of ocean to cover. Not even a battle fleet with a full squadron of frigates ideally placed ahead of the fugitive would have much chance of finding a single ship in the infinity of water. Clinton knew that his only chance was to reach the southern tip of the continent ahead of Huron and to take up station athwart the narrow shipping lane that was threaded around Cape Point. However, once Huron rounded the southern cape, the whole of the wide Atlantic would lie ahead of her, and she would be gone again. Clinton's jawline clenched spasmodically at the thought of the American escaping into that limitless expanse of sea. If she had indeed 11 days lead on him, with this wind holding fair, she could even at this moment be raising the rocky cliffs of Cape Point. He put the thought from his mind and concentrated on coaxing every inch of speed from his ship over the long days and nights ahead. Robin had searched in vain for a subterfuge to delay Huron's departure from the Rio Save, even though she knew that if she succeeded, she would be endangering the lives of all aboard her. However, Mungo St. John had swiftly regained his energy and determination as his wound healed and the effects of the inoculation passed. Affected by Robin's warning about the danger of battlefield plagues, he forced the pace of his crew in loading the slaves. They worked through the night by the light of tar-dipped rope torches, as well as by day, the crew every bit as eager as their captain to be away from this cursed river. 4 days after the loading began, Huron's slave decks were in place, and her cargo of slaves aboard. And that evening, at the full of the tide, using the last of the light and the first gusts of the offshore night breeze, Huron slipped over the bar, shook out her reefs, and settled down to make her offing during the night. At dawn they caught the steady push of the trades, and Mungo brought her round onto a more southerly heading, close hauled to make good their eastings before running for the bulge of Orgullis with the wind on the beam. The sweet clean air of the open sea that had travelled thousands upon thousands of miles since last having touched land swept through the ship, cleansing it of the dreadful stench of the plague barracoons, and Mungo's strict hygienic discipline helped to keep the holds free of the slave stink and impressed even Robin, though reluctantly, with his forethought and his precautions. By sacrificing a single slave deck, raising the space between each from the traditional 20 inches to 32 inches, he allowed not only greater comfort, but easier access. In these mild conditions of wind and sea, the slaves were exercised during all of the daylight hours. The higher headroom and wider ladderways enabled even those in the lowest decks to be brought up on deck in batches of 50 at a time. On the main deck, they were forced to dance to the rhythm of a tribal drum, beaten by a tattooed naked tribesman. The rattle and clink of their chains made a mournful background music to the drum and the sweet sound of the singing slaves. "Funny business, that tattooing," Nathaniel stopped to chat with Robin as she stood watching the dismal show. "They started tattooing their children to make them repulsive to us slavers. Some of them file or knock out their teeth. Like that one there." He pointed at a muscular black man in the circle of dancing slaves, whose teeth had been filed to sharp points like those of a shark. "Some of them put bones through their noses of their daughters, and others stretch their tits, begging your pardon at the plain speaking, ma'am, or they put rings of copper around their necks until they look like giraffes. Also, the slavers will leave them alone. They do say now that these have become marks of beauty amongst the heathen. No accounting for taste, is there, ma'am?" Robin saw how the extra space and regular exercise would affect the well-being of the slaves, and while they were up on the main deck in the open air, their empty slave decks were flushed out with seawater from the ship's pumps and then scrubbed down with a strong lye mixture. Though even this was not enough to prevent the slave stink slowly impregnating the ship. Each slave spent 2 hours on deck each second day. And while they were there, Robin held clinic and examined each of them for any signs of disease or injury. Before going below once more, they were each forced to drink a decoction of molasses and lime juice to supplement the plain diet of boiled farina and water, and to ward off the dreaded scourge of the scurvy.